All right. First of all, congratulations to everyone. We have survived a Dragon Con. Okay, so I've got a ton of slides. I'll go through them really fast. So I'm going to be talking about a few of the world's most famous unsolved codes. The one at the top left there is Kryptos. It's a sculpture at the center of CIA headquarters. It has four codes on it. Three of the four have been solved. The fourth hasn't been solved yet. Then we have on the right, we have something that's about 500 years old. It's called the Voynich Manuscript. I have a copy of it here. It's hundreds of pages of script we can't read, pictures of plants we don't recognize, little mechanisms that we don't know what they are. And then there is the Beale Papers I'll be going over. I gave a longer talk on this earlier in the con. Did anybody go to that talk? Oh, well, welcome back. So I'll be basically kind of going over in a more abbreviated form some of what I already did in the Skeptics track. Anybody else that's interested in seeing it, Skeptic will probably be posting videos later. And I'm also going to touch briefly on another cipher called the Dorabella cipher. So I have a list on my website, elonka.com, of the world's most famous unsolved codes. I'm going to be going over these four in this talk, and if anybody has questions on any of the others, feel free to ask later on. So I'll go over the Beale Papers first, because there's actually a documentary that's on television right now on the program called Myth Hunters, and they flew me out to Colorado. This is actually a small hotel room where they did the filming of this. If you look carefully, you can see a bed kind of under my right elbow, and behind me, that's the connecting door between suites. So they really were very creative how they did it. So hopefully this will now work, because we did a test earlier, and so therefore it should work, right? I'm only going to, this is like a 45-minute video. I'm only going to play like the first 5 minutes of it for you. So those of you that were at my talk at Skeptics, this is what didn't work, so now you get a chance to see it.
According to legend, in 1819, a group of men bury a fabulous treasure in the Virginia countryside.
Of gold and silver and jewels worth tens of millions of dollars.
Their leader, Thomas Beale, writes down the treasure's location in a secret code. He entrusts an innkeeper with its safekeeping, vowing to return. But then Thomas Beale vanishes.
Not only does Thomas Beale disappear, his whole party disappears. It's a complete mystery.
Years later, two brothers, George and Clayton Hart, take up the challenge of cracking Beale's mysterious code to recover his glittering treasure. During their 50-year quest, they turn to the world's most famous code breakers. And even the supernatural.
But when someone is hot on the trail of a treasure, they will use every possible means at their disposal.
In the 19th century, a seance was science. He genuinely believes that mesmerism will uncover the location of this treasure.
Theirs is an extraordinary quest to unravel the mystery of Thomas Beale's lost treasure.
Exciting stuff. So I kind of wanted that to kind of set the stage for there's just this excitement about things that are unsolved, and especially when there's a treasure involved, it really gets people interested in it. So now I'm going to kind of back up, and I'm going to go over what's the reality of this thing about the Beale ciphers. So let's go over here and there, and please work. Yay, okay, awesome. So so everything that's known about the Beale ciphers, it comes from one pamphlet that was published in 1885. And it described this man named Thomas J. Beale, who arrived in Virginia, and he had a story which was reproduced in the pamphlet as letters from Beale to an innkeeper named Robert Morris. And according to these letters, Beale, along with 30 gentlemen adventurers from Virginia, had gone west to hunt buffalo and grizzlies. And while they were out near about 300 miles north of Santa Fe, which was Mexican territory at the time, they were in the mountains and stumbled across a vein of gold and silver while they were hunting buffalo, trying to stampede them into a canyon. And then, so they, the 30 of them got together and spent a year and a half, 18 months mining this very rich gold and silver mine. And then they said, what are we going to do with it? And they told, they decided that Thomas Beale, who was the leader of the party, was going to put all the stuff into wagons and take it all the way back from Santa Fe, all the way back to Virginia, and bury it. And then later they would go and reclaim it, and that's how their families would get a hold of it. So Beale showed up, again, all of this according to the pamphlet, Beale shows up at Robert Morris's inn in Bedford County, Virginia, and he gives Morris a locked box and says, if I do not return in 10 years, go ahead and open this box. And the innkeeper took it, and it was very normal for innkeepers at the time to kind of be the banks, the safe deposit boxes. And Morris was a real individual. And he, according to the pamphlet, waited 10 years, actually waited many more years, in like 23 years, I think. And then Morris opens the box and finds these papers that are just covered with numbers. And again, according to the pamphlet, Morris can't really figure anything out. And then right before he dies, he gives them off to someone else. It's an anonymous person, the unnamed friend. And the unnamed friend spends decades looking at these papers and can crack, he solves the code on one of them. There's papers 1, 2, and 3. And the friend is able to solve the second one using a code with the Declaration of Independence. So I'll go through here, and I already told you this. So this is what paper number 2 looks like. Big series of numbers. I will not read this to you. but look at the top numbers if you can see them. So we have 115, 73, 24, 807, 37, 52, and so on. So if you take the Declaration of Independence, which is that document, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands that have connected them with another. So if those numbers, 115, 73, 24. So you go to the 115th word, that's the word instituted. And so you take the first letter of that, and that's the letter I. And then you take the 73rd word, and that's hold, so you take the H. Then you take the 24th word, which is another, and you have an A, so now we have I-H-A, and you keep going that way, and you get I-H-A-V-E, I have. And you keep going through the entire set of numbers like that, and it comes out to a message that says, I have deposited in the county of Bedford, about 4 miles from Buford's, in an excavation or vault, 6 feet below the surface of the ground, the following articles belonging jointly to the parties whose names are given in number 3 herewith. The first deposit consisted of 1,014 pounds of gold and 3,812 pounds of silver, deposited November 1819. The second was made December 1821 and consisted of 1,907 pounds of gold and 1,288 pounds of silver, also jewels obtained in St. Louis in exchange for silver to save transportation and valued at $13,000. The above is securely packed in iron pots with iron covers. The vault is roughly lined with stone, and the vessels rest on solid stone and are covered with others. Paper number 1 describes the exact locality of the vault so that no difficulty will be had in finding it. So, you know, it sounds like a great yarn, but there's all these weird kind of holes in the story. Like, why would someone go to the trouble of taking wagons full of gold all the way from Santa Fe, all the way back to Virginia? They were already kind of cashing some of it in St. Louis, which was a perfectly fine city. So they traded some for jewels and brought those and then buried those. But you know, it's the story, you know, has holes in it. Let's just say that. This is paper number 1, again, a series of numbers, supposedly the locality, and paper number 3, the names and residences. So was this a real treasure or a hoax? Well, there's been a lot of research done on this pamphlet. So the pamphlet reproduced this story by this unnamed friend, and also letters that were supposedly written by Beale. Some people have pointed out that there's inconsistencies in the language, like Beale's talking about stampeding buffalo. So supposedly that letter was written in 1822, but the word stampede did not really come into use in the language until around 1880 or so. Also, the idea that 30 men were mining gold for 18 months and word did not get out. You got to think of the California Gold Rush when two men knew about it, and it was discovered in January, and by March the word was spreading, and that was in 1848, resulting in the miners, the 49ers, all kind of descending on California. So the idea that 30 men were working for 18 months and nobody knew about it is a very suspicious thought. Also, the paper number 3 supposedly has the names of Beale's 30 associates and their relatives, and their addresses, but it's only got 618 characters. It's a very short message. So again, you try and think, how the heck are you going to put all that information into such a short message? Now, there may be ways that it could be done through kind of elaborate compression algorithms, or maybe a number represents more than a single letter. But again, it's a suspicious thing. This is paper number 3. So the general consensus now is that the entire thing was fiction, that it was written by a man named John William Sherman, who is a playwright and a journalist. And so he had a reputation for writing fiction. He also had many family connections to this area in Virginia. He was first cousin with Ward, the publisher of the pamphlet. He knew the people that were at Buford's Tavern. And he had been he had purchased this newspaper called the Virginian Newspaper in Lynchburg in 1885. So he'd sold the pamphlet, raised some money, bought the newspaper. The newspaper still runs into financial difficulties, and around the time that it had the financial difficulties, this ad appeared 84 times in the Virginian newspaper. So it would be expensive to run any ad 84 times, so it's likely that it was published by the owner of the newspaper, and it was never published in any other paper, only in the Virginian paper. And the ad talks about price 10 cents, and at the bottom, address, W.W. Watts, 1001 Main Street. 1001 Main Street is the address of the newspaper. W.W. Watts was a 14-year-old apprentice at the newspaper. So again, it all kind of ties in. So that's kind of the Beale, but very briefly. And so I know you guys want me to go quickly because you need to go and sleep. So the Voynich manuscript, as I said, I've got a copy of it here, hundreds of pages of this bizarre script. We've radiocarbon dated it, and the animals, the calves, from whom the vellum was made, lived between 1408 to 1438, which implies that's when it was made, but it's not certain, because maybe it's a copy of an older document, or maybe someone wrote it much later but obtained a blank book of older vellum. So all I'm saying is we know when the vellum was made, the animals from whom the vellum was made, 1400. So it implies that it was made in the 1400s. But it's written in no recognized language, even the alphabet. We've never found a single other document that uses the same alphabet. Hundreds of pages here, and you can go online and you can see these. There's only one copy in existence. It's at the Yale University Beinecke Rare Book Library. Some of the plants. When we show this to botanists, they'll say, oh yeah, like, oh, I recognize the leaves of that, but the roots would never be for those kinds of leaves. And they say, oh yeah, I kind of recognize that flower, but the leaves would never be with that kind of a flower. So it's sort of like someone mixed and matched, like took all the flowers and all the leaves and like shifted them off to the side. Right. And then there's all these strange little naked women that are in these green pools of water. And there's always kind of an input, and then there's, you see at the bottom right, there's always an output. So there's a sense of flowing water. So maybe it's implying herbal baths of some sort, and these were the herbs that were used in these baths. And some of the flowers, I mean, this looks like a passion flower. If someone knows flowers, oh yeah, it looks like a passion flower, but it's only got 5 petals. But passion flowers generally have 10 petals, so why would someone just change that little thing? If we were to transcribe this weird language, it would come out in this kind of pudero danle show aldi oto olge. So it has a rhythm as though it's a language. We know that the manuscript was probably made by one person, maybe two. They were right-handed, and they were writing from left to right. It's considered to be one of the world's greatest mysteries. So whoever made it had a lot of time, had means to get that much parchment. I mean, that was expensive stuff to get back in the 1400s, and the inks and the colors and the iron gall ink. Now, there were other documents that sort of look like that. This is another document that was called De Materia Medica from the 15th century, with real herbs that are recognized, and it's written out what these different herbs do. So it's sort of... It sort of looks like an herbal, but it's not really an herbal. This is one of the passion flowers. So again, we have real passion flowers on the left, always 10 petals. And then the one in the Voynich has 5. Interesting. I got a chance to see the Voynich up close for the first time. Yale University released it for a show. This was at the Folgers Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C. So I took my replica, and they let me pull up a chair and get really close to the case and compare my replica with the real Voynich, and it was very exciting for me. I got some very good pictures of it. I have to thank Timothy Ball was also taking some of these pictures. One of the things we noticed kind of looking at, if you look at the edges of the pages, it's interesting how these things kind of loop. And there are several pages that are folded, but it's different from other manuscripts of the time, which would have had more even pages. They wouldn't have had this kind of uneven looped pages. So again, it's just another mystery about the manuscript. One of the big fold-out pages is probably the most famous page in the Voynich. It's called the Rosettes page. And again, whoever made it spent a lot of time working on it. You know, what are these things here? Is it like a map? And these are representing kind of waves crashing against a causeway. This sort of looks like looking down at a farm from up above. And up here is a very interesting little detail, which is a little castle. And if you look at the battlements of the castle here, it's an interesting architectural element. Instead of looking like a square wave, it has these little dips in the battlement. That's an architectural element called a swallowtail merlon. And these days you can find castles like that all around. But in the 1400s, only in northern Italy would castles have that kind of element. So again, it sort of implies where the manuscript might have been made. So is it a code? Is it a hoax? It's possible it was a hoax. Around the time in the 1500s, there was Emperor Rudolph, who loved collecting curiosities. And so someone may have made this as a very elaborate, beautiful curiosity to sell to Emperor Rudolph for 600 gold ducats, which would be about $80,000 today. Or maybe they were using it as a catalog. Maybe they were selling herbal medications. And the you got to think this is about 100 years after the Black Plague. So maybe someone wanted to buy these medications, and the cost of the ointments would rise depending on the rarity of the herbs that were in those ointments. So someone may have used this to say, look at how rare these herbs are. You've never seen herbs like this. They come from far, far away. That is why I must charge so much money for these ointments. Maybe it was made by someone who was schizophrenic. Somebody in a well-to-do family, and they liked drawing, and they just kept, okay, here's more inks, here's more parchment. We don't know. And maybe it's in code. Maybe, you know, alchemy was always there, trying to turn lead into gold, and so people would write in code to hide their recipes for things. Yes, we don't know. It's called the Voynich Manuscript, by the way, because it came to public attention in 1912 when it was purchased by Wilfred Voynich, a rare book dealer. There was a monastery in Italy that was kind of selling off some of its collection because they were low on funds. So they were kind of discreetly selling some of their manuscripts. And Voynich went there, and he bought a few. And then he saw this one. He called it the ugly duckling of the collection because the others had these, you know, gold, beautiful drawings in the margins, and then there was this, which didn't have any of that, didn't have any religious symbols anywhere in it, but it was definitely an intriguing manuscript. So it could have been a hoax, but it took a long time to make. Maybe it's an artificial language, but you know, we've done a lot of statistical analysis. Famous code breakers, such as Friedman, who cracked codes in World War I, took a look at it. He thinks it's probably an artificial language. He also digitized the whole thing. So they figured out a possible alphabet, and then they put it on key punch cards. So you can go online and get the whole thing digitally. And maybe it's just random. Maybe someone, again, who was schizophrenic. But if so, it's a very regular pattern. It looks like words as you go through. Maybe it's encrypted. If it was encrypted, why? And so every question kind of leads to another question. Or maybe it was a real language. Maybe it was a micronation somewhere in Europe. And that has just disappeared, and this is the only surviving example of their language, of their written language. But we've never found a single other document anywhere that uses that language or even uses that alphabet. So again, lots of questions. So these are just other possible things. So yeah, called the world's most mysterious manuscript. Okay, next, going on to the Dorabella cipher. This was written in 1897 by composer Edward Elgar, who did that pomp and circumstance. Da, 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 da. And he was into cryptography as well. And he had written this message to a young woman who was not a cryptographer. And she was never able to solve it. And she kind of went back to him at one point and said, "And what does it say?" And he said, "I'm surprised with everything that you and I have talked about that you weren't able to solve it." Now, this is a cipher that he had used before. And my favorite code on the list is Kryptos, which I'm about to get to. But if we can ever solve Kryptos, this is the next one I want to go to because I believe it is solvable. I think the Voynich is probably a hoax. I think the Beale ciphers are probably a hoax, but this one I think is solvable. And I'd like to go and find Elgar's papers and see other times that he used this kind of cipher and see if that gives us any clue. Okay, now for my favorite one, crypto sculpture. How are we doing on time here? Okay, so sculpture at the center of CIA headquarters. It was commissioned when they built a new headquarters building. It's about 12 feet high, 20 feet long. It's got thousands of characters carved through these sheets of copper. A common misconception is that each of the four plates is a different code. That's not how it's constructed. Two of the plates are a cipher tableau called a visionaire tableau, and then the four ciphers are on two of the plates. So one, two goes down to the bottom of that plate, then three, and then the fourth is down at the very bottom, about 97 characters. It was commissioned in 1988, dedicated in 1990. It was the code systems were designed by a man named Ed Scheidt, still living, who was the chairman of a CIA cryptographic center, and the sculptor was a man named Jim Sanborn. Sanborn, when he got the gig, had never done anything with code. He'd never done anything with text before, but the CIA invited him to make art to go around their buildings, and then he did research on the CIA and decided he wanted to do something with the theme of encryption. So the director of the CIA at the time, a man named William Webster, teamed Sanborn with Ed Scheidt and said, "Ed, go teach Jim about codes." Ed spent a few months kind of going over some basic code things, and then Jim came up with the messages to be encrypted and carved them into the sculpture. It was a very long process. I got a chance to see Kryptos. Long story I'm not going to go into, but I was invited to CIA headquarters to give a talk about Al-Qaeda codes shortly after the September 11th attacks. And one of the things I wanted to do while I was at CIA was to see Kryptos. And each of these are rubbings that I did. So each one of these is done on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. So it kind of gives you an idea of the size of the letters that are on the sculpture. I also spent a lot of time researching who else has worked on Kryptos. Is it possible that one of the other big code breaker brains in Washington, D.C. has solved it? So there was a report at the CIA by a man named David Stein who had solved the first three parts. I saw a copy of that. I heard also that the NSA had been working on Kryptos, and so I asked for their notes, and the NSA said no. They said it's classified, and I'm like, this is a recreational cipher. This is not a matter of national security. There's no reason that this should be classified. I want to see this, and the NSA said no. And I said, I'm filing a Freedom of Information Act request on the NSA, which is supposed to be something that takes a couple months. It was a long thing. The story of it was that Kryptos was dedicated in 1990. 1992, the CIA's deputy director, who was Admiral William O. Studeman, said to the NSA, he'd previously worked at the NSA, but now he's at the CIA, and he says to the NSA, "Okay, you guys are so hot. Let's see how hot you are." So the director of the NSA at the time, that was Vice Admiral Mike McConnell, said, "Okay, let's try." And so he put together a four-person team at the NSA, and they put the NSA's computers, boom, onto Kryptos. And they were able to solve the first three parts, but not the fourth part, by December 1992. Then they sent a memo along to CIA saying they hadn't solved part four. One of the reasons is because part four is very short. And if this would have happened in wartime, they probably would have said, they would have stamped it as needs more collection, because they only had a short message. They would have needed more ciphertext to work with. For example, in World War II, when the whole Bletchley Park, the imitation game thing was going on, they had Enigma messages, just thousands of characters that were coming in. And because they had so much ciphertext to work with, they were able to really analyze it and find those very subtle mathematical patterns that let them decrypt it. So the NSA could not solve those 97 characters of K4 at the end, sent a memo, classified the whole thing, went on. So I file my Freedom of Information Act request, March 2010, saying I wanted all information related to the NSA team that was formed to solve the puzzles of the crypto sculpture. So I get a message back April 2010 saying, are you willing to pay search fees? I say, sure. In June 2010, I get a message from the NSA saying the search is completed. I've been placed in the first in, first out processing queue for non-personal easy cases. But since there were several cases ahead of mine, they were unable to respond within 20 days. I said, fine, no problem. 6 months go by. I hear nothing. So I write back to them, and they say, the referenced case is actively being worked and, in fact, has already made it through the first level of review. There are additional review and approval stages, and there are other cases ahead of yours, so it may be some time before you receive the response. I say, fine, no problem. 6 months later, May, well, five, I write back to them again. I say, and they say, the FOIA case is in the final approval stages. At this point, I have friends of mine in the government that are saying, Ilanka, this is government speak for go away. You're never going to get an answer to your FOIA. So several months later, I write back again anyway, and they say, your FOIA case is in the final approval stages. There are a number of cases ahead of yours in that queue. And again, I've got my government friends saying, you're never going to get an answer. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to keep writing. So finally, I get a big fat envelope. And this, and it's so it's taken years to do this, but it's a big memo, and it says, please forward to Admiral Studeman for info, and it's a copy of the memo that the NSA had been using. And I want to point out that this was released on May 21st, 2013, FOIA case 61191. That's me. I finally got this out of NSA. And it confirmed what I'd been told, which is that they had solved the first three parts and had not solved the fourth part. And people come to me and they say, hey, Ilanka, you know, maybe someone solved it and they're just not telling you they've solved it. And I'm like, I have enough friends in the government now that if someone had solved it, someone would come up to me at a restaurant or a bar and go, nudge, nudge, how you doing on cryptos? You know, and they'd have that little smirk. No one's done that. Instead, it's the opposite. They kind of act annoyed and angry that no one in their code departments have solved cryptos yet. There's even a crypto society at the NSA. Cryptos is their kind of poster child for codes that have not been solved. So, I believe no one has solved it, or at least no one has solved it in a way that can be reproduced by anyone else. Sure, maybe some of the government solved it, dropped it in a drawer, but you don't get credit for it that way. To get credit for solving a code, you have to solve it and provide enough of your method that someone else can duplicate your work. It's basic scientific method. So, a little bit more about cryptos. While I was researching about it, I was researching everything that the artist had done. So Jim Sanborn, I found out that after he had created cryptos, he had created this piece called the Untitled Cryptos piece, which he had then sold to a private collector. So I wanted to go track it down. It's in the home of a .com millionaire in California. And I called him up and I said, hi, can I come into your backyard and take pictures of your sculptures? And he said, sure. So I went in and I took pictures. And I found out that it reproduces all the text of cryptos on one side, and on the other side, it produces a bunch of Russian text, what's called the Cyrillic language. And those are encrypted documents from KGB, from the Russian side. And the artist liked this idea of encrypted CIA stuff juxtaposed with encrypted KGB stuff. And there's also a larger version of the sculpture, which is currently at the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, D.C. It's that big oval museum outside of it, and it's a little bit larger, about 20% larger. And the Russian text is also reproduced on another sculpture of the artist, which is called the Cyrillic Projector. So is anyone here from Charlotte? Okay, if you go to University of North Carolina, Charlotte, between the Friday and the Fretwell buildings, this sculpture exists. It's called the Cyrillic Projector. If you ask most people there, they have no clue what's on this. They think it's like the letters from local fraternities and sororities. But it's actually encrypted Russian text. And if you decrypt it, which our group did, it's from classified KGB documents. And it's got the clue to one of them. Here it says USA. That's actually Medusa, which is one of the key words that is used to solve the code. And I'll go into what it says and what crypto says. So going back to the untitled cryptos piece, excuse me, the sections on it are in a different order from what's on cryptos, but it's basically the same text. And the untitled version also has two extra dots. So this is the untitled cryptos piece, and you can see here's that part of the visionaire tableau. And then here's the ciphertext, E-N-D-Y-A-H-R, which I'll come back to later. This is the beginning of part three of cryptos, not of part one. And then right around here, there's two dots. Dot, dot. It's this, the letters are the same as what's on the sculpture at CIA headquarters, but the dots are different. Why the dots are there? Maybe related to the plain text of it, but it's just interesting that the artist would do it. It might be a clue. We don't know. If the dots were on cryptos itself, they would be right about there. So what do these things say? Well, they're encrypted with a measure, with a method called Visionnaire, named after a French cryptographer named Blaise de Visionnaire. And two of the plates of cryptos have what's called a visionaire tableau or a visionaire table. So the way this is put together is that you start off with a keyword. In this case, the word is cryptos. And you make a cipher alphabet, a key alphabet. And you do this by taking the 26 letters of the alphabet, and then you take all the letters of your key out, put them at the left, and then you mush up all the rest of the letters over to the right. So you still have a 26-letter string, but it is scrambled in a very specific way. All right? Everybody okay on that? Okay, so now you take that key alphabet and you can put it in a tableau where each one is shifted by one. And so we have, it's the crypto cipher alphabet going all the way down. And so you get these lovely diagonals, like all the Q's coming down and all the Z's and the K's. Also, you see, you have the key, which you can see here, cryptos. And also if you read down vertically, down this left column, you can also see the word cryptos, right? So now we're going to take it up a level. And instead of vertically having the word cryptos, we're going to put another key, which is the word palimpsest, right? So again, you take each alphabet, put it down, and then take the letters of palimpsest, and then line them up. Okay. So palimpsest is a word for a scroll that has had one message written on it, then that message was scraped off, and another message was written on the scroll in a way that you can see bits of the old message showing through. The word palimpsest is also used in other contexts. For example, if you're in the city of Rome, you could say it's a palimpsest because you could be standing on a street corner and you could see the Roman Colosseum, like the history showing through. You could also see medieval cathedrals showing through along with the modern office building. So Rome is a palimpsest. So part one is these two lines here at the top. And with that tableau, with cryptos and palimpsest, we take that first line, E-M-U-F-P-H-Z, and you put each letter on a different line, E-M-U-F-P. And then you go up to the reference alphabet. So E becomes B, M becomes E, U becomes T, F becomes W, and you go on. So E-M-U-F-P-H-Z becomes B-E-T-W-E-E-N, between. And you keep going like that, and you can pull out the entire message. So this is the ciphertext using the two keys of cryptos and palimpsest. And the plain text is, between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of illusion. Now you see there's a Q there. It's not a typo on the slide. That's the way it's carved into the sculpture. I asked Sanborn about that. I said, was it just a mistake? And he said, no, it's deliberate, but it's not what it is that's so important. It's the orientation or the positioning. I don't know what that means either. So part two starts here on the third row, goes all the way down to the bottom of this plate, uses the same method as part one. So this is the ciphertext. Now, in this one, Sanborn did admit that he'd made a mistake. Down here, he'd left out a letter. the letter S. And because of the way this cipher is done, by putting that letter there, it changes all the other letters. It's not just shifting them, it's actually modifying them. So this one, the keys, Cryptos and abscissa. Abscissa is a mathematical term meaning the x-coordinate on a graph. Plain text. It was totally invisible. How is that possible? They used the Earth's magnetic field, X. The information was gathered and transmitted underground to an unknown location, X. Does Langley know about this? They should. It's buried out there somewhere. X. Who knows the exact location? Only WW. This was his last message, X. 38 degrees, 57 minutes, 6.5 seconds north, 77 degrees, 8 minutes, 44 seconds west, ID by Rose. We thought that's what it said. Then when Sanborn admitted there was a missing letter, it changed the last part to say X, layer 2, which of course is much more understandable. So the coordinates point to Langley in the area of CIA headquarters. WW is William Webster, who was the director of the CIA at the time that the sculpture was installed. And I'll go into more detail about that in a minute. So part three starts at the top of this plate, goes down to about here. Now this uses an entirely different method. Instead of the visionaire tableau, which is what's called a substitution method, this uses a transposition method. So it means the letters are all there. They don't change into something else, though they're just scrambled in a very certain way. So the trick with this is to know the method of scrambling or to derive it through something else. Now, one way that I came up with is to take all the letters of part three, put them at very even rows, and then start here in the middle of this right-hand column and get the letter S, and then go down by four to an L, go down another four to an O, four to a W, and you keep going S, L, O, W, L, Y, and you can get the word slowly, slowly, desperately. So you get these lovely diagonals, and you keep doing that, and you can pull out all the message that way. So the plain text of part three is slowly, desperately slowly, the remains of passage debris that encumbered the lower part of the doorway was removed. With trembling hands, I made a tiny breach in the upper left-hand corner, and then, widening the hole a little, I inserted the candle and peered in. The hot air escaping from the chamber caused the flame to flicker, but presently details of the room within emerged from the mist. X. Can you see anything? Q. Anybody recognize that? Yeah, King Tut's tomb. Yeah, this is a paraphrased extract from November 26, 1922, the diary of Howard Carter, British archaeologist Howard Carter, on the day he discovered and opened King Tut's tomb. Sanborn had read that passage as a child, and it really impressed him. And he said he put it on the sculpture because he thought that solving a code was very similar to this, of the idea of archaeology, kind of wiping away the layers and gradually getting to the plain text underneath. Then there's part four, 97 characters at the end. Can't tell you what it says. We don't know. So Cryptos, this was on my opportunity to visit it, it's in the courtyard between the original and new headquarters buildings. So this was the original headquarters building, and then in the 1980s, they commissioned a new headquarters building, so that's this one on this side. This white building with the funny-shaped roof, that's the cafeteria. That's where CIA employees go for lunch. There's a big line of windows along this side of the cafeteria so they can look out into this courtyard, and Cryptos is about here in this courtyard. This is another image. Sorry. Again, this is the cafeteria. There is a landscaped area, a duck pond, and Cryptos is here. There are some trucks down here. I don't know if you can see them in this slide, but down here you can kind of get a sense of size by the cars and the trucks there. Sanborn designed Cryptos. He designed this entire landscaped area, and he designed some rocks out here. Another view. Cryptos here. There's a duck pond and some pieces here. And these are some other stones. They're tilted out of the ground with copper sheets in between them, with Morse code messages carved into those sheets. They say things like, SOS, shadow forces. Lucid memory, T is your position. There's also a magnetic lodestone. There is a compass rose carved in where the needle is not pointing to north, it is pointing at that lodestone. This is reminiscent of other pieces that Sanborn has made. He liked playing with the idea of magnetism, so he would carve compass roses into some of his works. We have gone and looked and tried to see where all the compass roses are pointing to see if they intersect at some place in Washington, D.C., but there was nothing that came from that. So the coordinates point to right about here, which is about 150 feet southeast of the sculpture. It's also interesting where it says 6.5 seconds north, because anyone here a geocacher? Okay, so you know that a tenth of a second of latitude is a very specific location, about 10 feet across. So it's 6.5. It's not 6 seconds, it's not 7 seconds, 6.5 seconds. And so some people say, oh, it's supposed to point to Cryptos. No, that's 150 feet southeast of Cryptos. And he said 6.5, so that's pretty specific. But we haven't seen anything there. I mean, these gray dots are round lunch tables, the kind you can kind of move around. Possibly it's referring to something else with layers, because CIA has layers that go underground. So there might be, I don't know, there might be an office 3 layers down that has ceiling tiles, and there's something hidden in the ceiling tiles. I've met Sanborn, and he's talked about how he goes out to CIA like every 10 years or so to kind of inspect everything. And one of the things he said to me was, Ilanka, you got to know that the topography is different now. The shape of the landscape has changed. And I don't know what that means, but it was important for him to tell me that, for whatever that means. Right. So again, we have some granite slabs, the duck pond. You can see there's a diagonal here and a parallel diagonal here. Sanborn said that was deliberate. And then there's this little triangle block, which doesn't have any Morse code messages, just sitting there, sort of pointing, looks like an arrow. So other things that we've noticed on the Visionaire tableau side, where all like the Q's and the V's and the X's are, that there's an extra L here. This, at the end of the line, should be the same as what the alphabet is, E, F, G, H, I, J, L, M, but it goes E, F, H, I, L, L, M, N, Q. And it's interesting also that this line is the same as the other side of the sculpture, where there's some letters that are sort of out of alignment. Interesting thing. It's possible that Sanborn was creating the sculpture as a way to draw the eye to something where there would be a clue. And we think he did this on another sculpture, on the Cyrillic projector, where, remember I said USA, and then we had Medusa. This is one of the key words to the sculpture, Medusa. And then Tien, which was the word for darkness or shadow. And where does this word Medusa come from on the sculpture? Well, it comes from the third line from the bottom of this plate. Now, if you go in and you look at that third line, there's an extra bolt there, or there was. It's changed now. But John Wilson went out and took a look, and he said, if you look at it from the other side, it's really obvious that there's a hole. Now there's just a hole there, but that there is an extra bolt. So it's possible that Sanborn did this as a way of drawing the eye to that line, maybe. So where did Sanborn learn about codes? From this guy named Ed Scheidt. And Scheidt has said he did things to mask the English in part four, and that we cannot solve it with the benefit of the English language. He said we solved the first three parts, where you can use the English language like you know the frequency, you know that there's going to be more E's and T's than there are Q's and Z's. You can know things about doubled letters and other things. But he said that he changed that for part four. Mask the English. So he said the first thing we need to do is to figure out the masking technique. He said he used a little bit of steganography. Steganography is a way of hiding something inside of a message. But he has said it's solvable. He said that it's in English. And he said that it uses all the letters. So those are very important clues. I'm also hosting a dinner in Washington, D.C. in October, where I'm going to have both Ed Scheidt and Jim Sanborn and some of the members of the NSA team all in a room, get them all talking. So if anybody happens to be in D.C., you are welcome to come. Just send me an email. Just contact me, and I'll give you the information. Or join the Cryptos group. I'll give you some information on that. Okay. So Sanborn did give a hint in 2010 for characters 64 through 69. The ciphertext there is the letters NYPVTT, and he said that that's actually the word Berlin. And so this caused a flurry of activity in our group, like, oh my God, we have a crib, we have part of the plain text. And what we found is that we could get the word Berlin to show up there with the visionaire system, so using that visionaire system, but instead of keys like cryptosynapsista, if we use the words shifted and binary, we could get the word Berlin to show up right there, but we couldn't get anything intelligible before or after it. Then we found, I mean, shifted and binary are like wonderful keys, but lots of other keys also produce the word Berlin at exactly that location, like subcompact Gorky and misused crafty. So we don't know if it's just a coincidence or, you know, shifted could be a very related key and binary could be a key because he has made some other sculptures that have binary code in them. We were wondering, is it Berlin? Is it maybe two words like amber line or number of links could put the word Berlin? But Sanborn has said, no, it's the city. It's the word Berlin. He's also said that even after we solve all four parts of Kryptos, that there's a further puzzle after that. And then 4 years later, he said, here's another word. And so after Berlin, MZFPK, that ciphertext is the word clock. So we now have over 10% of part four. We still don't know what the damn thing says. But we know that the right around here, we have the words Berlin and clock. And Sanborn has said there are many interesting clocks in Berlin, which may or not be related to the cipher. But it's very frustrating that we have this much of it. I'd like to know what part four says and then come back and look at it and go, what did we miss? Where did we go wrong? So on that line with the extra L, there's also this. These letters are slightly out of alignment. And Sanborn, I've shown him my slides, and he has pointed at this and said, this is important. But we don't know. We don't know if it's related to part four. We don't know if it's related to part three in some way, parts one and two, but he has said it's important. Another interesting he said is that for a long time, this was the main picture of Kryptos. You could go to Wikipedia, and that was the picture. You could go to articles in the New York Times, that was the picture. And Sanborn said, don't use that picture. I'm like, why not? He said, it's ugly. Like, what do you mean? He said, that's not the front. And I said, well, what's the front? He said, that's the front. So this is very important to him, that this is the front of Kryptos, and that's a side picture of Kryptos. I don't know if it's related to the crosshairs or maybe something about the rocks. I've talked to members of his extended family, and they've said they don't know what it says, but they do know he's very detail-oriented. And if a certain rock is placed in a certain way, he wanted that rock to be placed in exactly that way. So Berlin, the Berlin clock. CIA does have a lot of connections with Berlin, so this is just kind of all theoretical. The Berlin Wall was falling in around November 1989, which is right around the time that Sanborn was creating the sculpture. So it's possible that he carved into the sculpture something related to the falling of the Berlin Wall. We don't know. There is a Berlin Wall monument, which is at the CIA, which is dedicated in December 1992. It's possible that Sanborn knew that this was going to be installed, so the coordinates may have been where the monument was supposed to be. I don't know. You know, as I said, the coordinates are here. The actual monument is installed over here. Also, I just want to say, before anybody gets too excited about the graffiti, I'm like, oh my God, historical. No, when the CIA got these slabs, which are from the Berlin Wall, they were blank. There was no graffiti on them. The CIA then hired an artist to go in and paint fake graffiti on the slabs. You'll also notice it's all in English. So anyway, I just want to point that out. So then there's the ciphertext. Famous. We don't know what it means. Now, it does have some references in pop culture. For example, Dan Brown wrote a book called The Da Vinci Code. If you have this hard copy version, there are five puzzles that are hidden in the artwork of the book jacket, which are giving clues to the subject of his next novel. For example, on the back of the book, in this fake brown tear here, are the words, only WW knows, which is a reference to part two of Kryptos. Also, on the back where all the blurbs are, very faintly light red on dark red are the numbers 37 degrees 57 minutes 6.5 seconds north, 77 degrees 8 minutes 44 seconds west. Now some of you may notice, wait a minute, Crypto said 38 degrees, 57 minutes, 6.5 seconds north. And I mentioned that to Dan Brown, and he said, yeah, the discrepancy is intentional, for whatever that means. So Dan Brown actually called me up, because he was doing some research on Kryptos for his next novel, and so he wanted me to kind of tell him what was going on with Kryptos, and were there any new discoveries, and what did I know about the coordinates, and this and that. Because Kryptos did factor into his next novel, the sequel to Da Vinci Code, which was called The Lost Symbol. Kryptos is a recurring theme, and I was very honored when I read halfway through that there is a character in there named Nola Kay, which is named after me. Dan Brown had put in a character with Nola Kay as an anagram form of Ilanka. So that was his way of thanking me. So, K4, why hasn't it been solved yet? Well, one, it's very short. It's possible there's a key that's on CIA grounds. Kryptos was never intended as a public challenge. It was intended as a challenge to the employees at the CIA. It's also possible we missed something, or we might have been misdirected in some way. But it might have a mistake on it. But both Sanborn and Scheidt have said that it is solvable. And people ask me if I want to be the one to solve it. And I say, no, I just want to see it solved. I want it off my plate. So if I can help by sharing as much information as possible with other people, I'm happy to do that. If you'd like more information, I do have a book. You can get that on Amazon. There's a wonderful documentary on PBS, on Nova Science Now, about Kryptos. I have a website, ilanka.com/kryptos. There's also a Yahoo group. So anyone that's interested in coming to the dinner, just send an email to kryptos-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. And then that's where we're posting information about the dinner. I've also written a couple articles about Kryptos in this book called Secrets of the Lost Symbol. And, of course, you can just go and Google. Anyone who wants to learn more about codes in general, my number one recommendation is a book by Simon Singh, S-I-N-G-H, called The Code Book. Wonderful overview of cryptography. If you want to get more into it, a book by David Kahn called The Code Breakers. And then if you want to get into modern cryptography, like what happens when you put your card into an ATM, or what do banks use as they're communicating across the planet, Bruce Schneier is the guy. Schneier.com, he does a regular newsletter called Cryptogram. And if you want to follow modern cryptography, start with Schneier. Absolutely. Okay, any questions? Throw them the microphone?
Yeah. The thing about that Berlin thing was you had two T's at the end, but it coded to two different letters. How did you figure that? You noticed that, of course.
Yeah, because it's if the two T's would come out to the same letter, that would be what's called a monoalphabetic substitution cipher, but because we're using a polyalphabetic, it's sort of like where I said with palimpsest and Kryptos. So since each letter is being encrypted off of a different key alphabet, you could have two T's, you could have seven T's, and each one could decrypt to a different letter. Absolutely.
Hi, I've been just recently looking into a book about runes, and they were talking about how the buildings have cryptic messages on the sides of their architecture in Germany and Northern Europe that are runes. I wonder if that's, and also, I also read recently a book about knitting and putting messages in your knitting with various types of knots, and I was really shocked about that because, like, I never thought anybody was sending me a message with their knitting. I was just wondering, and also I've heard about silks, that they do that in Asia. I wonder if that is used or incorporated in any of this. I was thinking if you used a knitting pattern, maybe you could change the position of the word based on knitting shifts. I just wondered.
Yeah, you can make a code with anything. Yeah, I'm sorry, did you have something else you wanted to say?
No, I was just curious.
Yeah, and Friedman would do this, and he would like draw a picture of a plant, right, with all the little leaves and stems, and he would make some stems crooked at the end and some stems straight. And what it was to do is that every place that it was crooked would be like a one, and every place that it was straight would be a zero. And you can use anything. I've done codes. I didn't do it in this presentation, but where I could have certain letters that were a different color, and every place you would see them, if you marked each slide, you could get a code out that way. You can do things with all kinds of interesting things with ones and zeros. There's a photograph of a code breaking team where it's one of those long panorama pictures, you know, that you get from like high school or something. But what they did is where some of the people would look forward and some look to the side. And if you go through, you can get a code by saying the ones that are forward are zeros and the ones that are looking to the side are ones. And what it comes out to is the message that says knowledge is power.
Is there a way to assign colors to letters and use color to create a cryptic message?
Sure, sure.
So
absolutely.
That is used too. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Any other questions? Okay. Again, congratulations at surviving DragonCon. Just lots of fun stuff here. And if you want to play with any of them, who knows? You might be the one that solves it. Thank you. Okay.